historic moment just happened. The United Nations just voted almost by consensus in favor of this treaty to prohibit the use of nuclear weapons and to move forward with getting rid of them. This is a tremendous moment because it's saying the rest of the nation don't want this, don't want to proceed with this, and so for truly moving forward with the abolition of nuclear weapons.
When you hear breathtaking information like that, you're right in thinking that maybe, just maybe, there might truly be a way out of the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, our featured interview is with Dr. Gordon Edwards of Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. We talk about the proposed Chalk River nuclear waste megadump, which just happens to be adjacent to the Ottawa River and upstream from the drinking water for Ottawa and Quebec. And as you heard, we have a special report from Heidi Huttner. She is director of the Sustainability Studies Program at Stony Brook University and associate dean in the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. Heidi was calling us directly from the United Nations within an hour of passage of that nuclear bomb ban. Very exciting audio. Plus, of course, we have our regulars, Numbnuts of the Week, for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the nuclear reactor duck, and cover report about the latest problems with our crumbling fleet of U.S. nuclear reactors, plus news, attitude, and more honest nuclear information than the G20 nations bothered to discuss with Donald Trump or probably anyone else. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 11, 2017, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off with the big planetary story, after a decades-long effort by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, and 72 years after their invention, on Friday, July 7, 2017, nation states at the United Nations formally adopted a treaty which categorically prohibits nuclear weapons. Until now, nuclear weapons were the only weapons of mass destruction without a prohibition treaty, despite the widespread and catastrophic humanitarian consequences of their intentional or accidental detonation. Biological weapons were banned in 1972 and chemical weapons in 1992. Now, ICAN's executive director, Beatrice Finn, said, "We hope this marks the beginning of the end of the nuclear age. It is beyond question that nuclear weapons violate the laws of war and pose a clear danger to global security. No one believes that indiscriminately killing millions of civilians is acceptable, no matter the circumstance. Yet that is what nuclear weapons are designed to do." Today, she was speaking on Friday, "Today, the international community rejected nuclear weapons and made it clear they are unacceptable." To provide a sense of what it was like to experience this historic event, we called Heidi Huttner at the United Nations. She was present for the discussions over many weeks. As I said, she is the Director of Sustainability Studies Program and Associate Dean in the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University. We spoke less than an hour after the vote took place. And you can hear it in the overlapping excitement of our exchange.
Heidi, where are you and what just happened?
Well, I'm at the UN in New York City, and a historic moment just happened. The United Nations just voted almost by consensus, one vote abstention, one against, and all of the other 122 voted in favor of this treaty to prohibit the use of nuclear weapons and to move forward with getting rid of them. Now, we know that, you know, the nine nuclear nations are not here and they're not participating. But this is a tremendous moment because it's saying the rest of the nation don't want this, don't want to proceed with this. And so for truly moving forward with the abolition of nuclear weapons.
In reading about this, I have been in tears this morning.
Tears, lots of tears. Okay, so here was the moment. I was in there when they voted, when the vote was announced and sealed officially, and people were cheering, crying, hugging. It was a really powerful moment. And I was right next to the two nuclear nuns, Carol Gilbert and Ardeth Platt, and they were the two nuns who went to jail in protest of nuclear weapons, and they were crying. All the women from ICANN who have come from all over the world weeping. And then Kathleen Sullivan, who from the Hibakusha stories, Robert Kronquist, who's also from Hibakusha, everyone was weeping. Many women from all over the world, and then Australia, Japan, India. There was an amazing speech by the ambassador from South Africa who spoke about this being the eve of Nelson Mandela Day, and how he is watching in this moment and weeping and so proud of this vote.
It is thrilling, even from a distance, to know what has happened and that the history is here right in front of us right at this moment. And what's the next step? What do we do to start implementing this around the world, including here in the United States, which has been probably will be the last one to sign on?
Right. So I think what this is saying is, look, we have the rest of the world in support of this. And for those of us who are active and advocates on behalf of the abolition of nuclear weapons, we can now use this as a tool to both divest from banks that invest in nuclear weaponry. It's a really big one, the divestment campaign, and get this message out on social media. Everyone should be doing it. You've got plenty of opportunity now. You have material to work with. You can go to the ICANN website. They're leaders internationally in promoting this, so there's lots of photographs and material there and articles. You can follow me, HeidiHuttner.com. You can follow me on Facebook. I've got lots of photos. And retweet, re-Facebook. I mean, get it out there. We know our president. We know these people. Social media works. So use that and write letters to your editor, you know, tell your congressmen, reinforce this and congresswomen and senators, reinforce how important this is and how we need to join with the rest of the world and abolish these horrific, horrific weapons.
In looking at the film that you posted, the video that you posted about the moment when the vote happened and everybody standing and applauding, the one thing that bothered me was in the panning around the room, I did not see any. I saw one camera that looked like it was from a major news organization, and it was that kind of a camera. But other than that, I did not see any significant video presence from the mainstream media. Have you gotten coverage?
There is coverage. They're not allowed in that room. So I don't know how those people got. I mean, I walked in and turned my iPhone on. I'm not even technically supposed to be there. I'm not part of, quote, civil society, but I'm there anyway, and no one's sort of stopping me. But there is a camera room that you couldn't see where there are cameras, and they're videoing from a side point. So, yes, there is media here, but they're not allowed in that room. In fact, I had a cameraman who was supposed to come with me, and he explained he can't go in that room, and there was an event prior to, it was supposed to be 8:30 this morning, and we have terrible weather here, so there was going to be a lot of coverage of that, and it's raining, and we couldn't do it. It was going to be outside, because the cameras here are very limited where they're allowed to shoot. That's why you didn't see them.
Thank you for clearing that up, because I'm always looking for where the media is.
I'm looking at media right now, actually, in another spot. There's a bunch of cameras. So the Japanese Nippon is here. I just was talking to them at length. And Nippon media is here. So Japanese are watching. I'll tell you that for sure.
So at this point, we need to, not only today, but every day moving forward, we need to tweet, we need to Facebook, we need to use every social media tool that we have. And also to put people in touch with Don't Bank on the Bomb, which has what you say, bank about divesting from nuclear weapons, because they may not want to look for voices, but they will listen to our money when it starts to disappear.
Absolutely. And I want to make one more point, and I have a piece coming out in Ms. Magazine and print in the fall on this and in other places, TVA, is that in the preamble and in this treaty, there is, and this is a historic thing, and people should just really pay attention. So, and we have Mary Olson to thank for this, who's been speaking internationally on this issue, and also the work of Arjun Makajani. Their work shows, and I'm sure you know this, but not everyone does, that women are disproportionately affected by exposure to radiation, significantly so. Women are twice as likely to get cancer from the same exposure to radiation as an adult white male, and children are many more times likely to get cancer from that, and little girls most of all. And fetuses are the most vulnerable. So that is actually in the treaty, which is extraordinary. And this is not, you know, a social justice issue, although it is social justice. It's a health issue. It's a scientific fact. And so that is in the treaty, and also the impact, the disproportionate impact on indigenous communities. That's also radical. So this is an important treaty, and it's really calling attention to this issue. Now, so for those of us concerned about nuclear power, remember, radiation is radiation. So you know, don't shy away from covering this problem of nuclear bombs. I mean, it's all connected. Radiation and safety, health dangers is applicable to all radiation, right? All ionizing radiation. So we need to pay attention to it. And I'm really thrilled. And I know Mary's thrilled. I met with Mary and I interviewed her and I interviewed Arjun, and they gave wonderful presentations early on in this conference. And I heard them, and I'll be writing about that.
I've had Mary on the show several times talking about that very issue, and I will undoubtedly be rerunning it very soon. Anything final you would like to say in celebration of this momentous, truly historic moment and event?
I would say, look what these people accomplished. It is truly remarkable. That means if we keep putting the pressure on, we keep getting active, we don't lose heart and say, oh, nothing can be done. I mean, something historic has just been done. This is huge. Now we must continue. It's not over. And now we must bring in the nuclear nations. And we can and we will.
Yes, we will. Heidi Huttner, Director of the Sustainability Studies Program and Associate Dean of the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University. You can follow her work, which is brilliant and nonstop, at HeidiHuttner.com. We'll have a link up on the website. Now, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons will be open for signatures by member states at the United Nations as of September 20th. All it will take is 50 of these states to ratify and make the treaty legal. Then it's a matter of implementing, but we're all going to get to work on that. And there will be information in the final thought today on how you, yes, you, in your own hometown, wherever that may be, can participate in ending nuclear weapons. In other news this week, hackers have breached at least a dozen U.S. power plants in attacks in May and June alone, according to intelligence officials. Hackers sent highly targeted emails to senior engineers at operating firms behind the nuclear plants, mimicking job applications but laced with malicious code, according to the New York Times. These techniques resemble those used by Russian specialists linked to previous attacks on energy facilities. Bob Alvarez of the Institute for Policy Studies cited five previous times that hacker attacks have been effective: in 1902 at Ignalina nuclear power plant in Lithuania, 2003 the Ohio-based nuclear power plant Davis-Besse, in 2006 at Browns Ferry in Alabama, the 2010 Stuxnet virus used at the Bashir nuclear facility in Iran, and in 2014, hackers infiltrated the South Korean hydro and nuclear power company's commercial network. In 2016, the Nuclear Threat Initiative noted that cyber attacks are increasing, and many states have essentially no effective security measures at nuclear facilities to address these cyber threats, like Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant at the foot of Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Despite the fact that the nuclear sites Pilgrim as one of the nation's worst performers, the facility is looking to take a pass on cybersecurity measures because, hey, it's only going to be operating for another year and a half. What could go wrong? As Diane Turco, president of the Cape Downwinders Citizen Group, said, "Planning to close Pilgrim within 2 years should not release Entergy from being accountable for mandated public safety upgrades." A quick look at other reactor problems with Doc and cover. Grand Gulf in Mississippi had an event or condition that, at the time of discovery, could have prevented the fulfillment of the safety function of structures or systems that are needed to mitigate the consequences of an accident. Susquehanna in Pennsylvania lost secondary containment, a loss of safety function as well. Oyster Creek in New Jersey had a scram or a sudden shutdown of the reactor, like screeching on the brakes, which is never good for any car, let alone a nuclear reactor. And as regards Diablo Canyon in California, late this morning, Judge Mary H. Strobel ruled against the World Business Academy's lawsuit to require the California State Land Commission to revisit Pacific Gas and Electric's Diablo Canyon lease by requiring an environmental review. This for a nuclear reactor built on multiple earthquake faults directly on the Pacific Ocean with known problems already with dry casks. Thanks to Myla Reason for the heads up, and we will have more details on this breaking story next week. Closing out the U.S. report with this numbnuts adjacent story. At the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge, which is what they are calling the former nuclear weapons production facility and Superfund site, around 300 prairie dogs are going to be relocated to the area. While environmentalists say, oh, the prairie dogs will be just fine, Leroy Moore with Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice says, this makes a bad problem worse. They will bring up plutonium, meaning when they dig in the ground, and it will blow onto the refuge. We don't know what will happen to the prairie dogs themselves, but they will endanger humans. Over to Japan, where the head of that country's nuclear regulation authority told Tokyo Electric Power Company's top management he questions their attitude towards decommissioning of the triple meltdown Fukushima nuclear power plant and the company's ability to resume operating its other reactors. NRA Chairman Shinichi Tanaka said during a special meeting with top management of TEPCO, I feel a sense of danger. Under consideration is whether to approve TEPCO's plans to resume operations of two reactors at its massive Kashiwazaki Kariwa plant in Niigata Prefecture. The NRA's safety screening found that TEPCO failed to report insufficient earthquake resistance for an emergency response center at the Niigata complex, even though it knew about the insufficiency for 3 years. Tanaka said, an operator lacking the will to take the initiative does not have the right to resume operation of nuclear reactors. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, numbnuts of the week.
The European Union is considering lifting an import restriction on rice produced in Fukushima Prefecture, which was hit with the triple meltdowns and is still leaking radioactive water into the Pacific, to the tune of 300,000 liters a day. And they're also considering lifting their import restrictions on wild vegetables and marine products from Japan, including shrimp, crab, octopus, yellowtail, red sea bream, and bluefin tuna. Well, what do you expect? 6 years? Why not lift the restrictions? After all, the 2020 Tokyo Olympics are just 2 years away, and the illusion must be created internationally that food that comes from Japan and specifically from northeast Japan around Fukushima is safe to eat, whether it is or not. And for whatever reasons or trade agreements or money under the table or whatever it took for the consideration of this ban to be lifted and the need for these radiological certificates to be lifted, you, European Union, are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, numbnuts of the week.
Some good news. In Germany, their Renewable Energy Federation reported on Sunday, July 9, that renewables supplied a record 35% of the country's power in the first 6 months of 2017, a 2% increase from 2016. In comparison, in the United States, we generated only 15% of our total electricity from renewables. France may close as many as 17 nuclear reactors by 2025 as it seeks to reduce the share of nuclear power in its electricity mix. This according to Environment Minister Nicolas Hulot on Monday, July 10. The Russian state's nuclear corporation Rosatom is losing hope in its international nuclear build campaign. Rosatom's deputy director, Vyacheslav Pershuskov, called the market for nuclear power stations abroad exhausted. That was his word. We see that the market is contracting, and for the sustainable growth of the corporation, we must make our money on something other than nuclear technology. Word is that they are eyeing a move into renewables. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, where else are you going to actually hear from someone who is in the room at the United Nations less than an hour after the vote at the United Nations to ban nuclear weapons, except here on Nuclear Hot Seat? And maybe some YouTube videos, many of which we will be linking to on the website. But still, I know you care about getting honest, verifiable, cutting-edge nuclear news. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this show. And that's what we set out to provide at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable information, sourced and checked, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on aspects of the nuclear industry that the nuclear industry would rather you not know about. We do incur costs to put this show together, and that's where we need your help, and that's why I ask you every week for it. In order to continue to bring you the most accurate, the most recent, the most cutting-edge information possible, we need your help. Any size donation will help. You can go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button, follow the prompts, you'll know what to do. If you want to set up a recurring donation of just $5 a month, the same as the cost of a cup of coffee and a good tip for the barista, you can do that at the big green donate button we've now instituted. Help keep Nuclear Hot Seat alive and kicking by helping us meet our expenses. And know that I and all of us who work on the show are deeply grateful for whatever you can do to help us keep kicking Sirius Nuclear Posterior. Now for the interview, and it's a humdinger. Dr. Gordon Edwards is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. He is one of Canada's best-known independent experts on nuclear technology. It seems that there is nothing that this man doesn't know. Since he became involved with nuclear issues in 1977, he has worked with the Canadian government, First Nations tribal councils, consulted with government and non-government bodies, and spoken internationally at conferences sponsored by Physicians for Global Survival, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Dr. Helen Caldicott, and many others. This interview is the first in a three-part discussion we did on Canadian nuclear issues. In part one, we discuss the Chalk River facility and its current plans for over 70 years' worth of nuclear waste. It's not a pretty picture. Dr. Gordon Edwards, so good of you to be joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure, Libby.
Let's start out talking about the proposed Chalk River radioactive waste megadump. Give us some background on the Chalk River site so those of us who aren't familiar with it can understand what it is, what's there, and why it's so dangerous.
Well, the Chalk River site was first of all established in 1944 by a decision made in Washington, D.C. It was a military decision connected with the World War II atomic bomb project, and the idea was to build the highest flux reactor in the world, which would be particularly good at producing plutonium for bombs. And indeed, the first reactor at Chalk River was started up exactly 1 month after the bombing of Hiroshima. It was the ZEEP reactor, Zero Energy Experimental Pile, and there was a bronze plaque, which has now been removed, stating that this reactor was part of the World War II atomic bomb project. It was part of the plans to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. The ZEEP reactor was just a small pool reactor to provide details for the larger reactor, which is called the NRX reactor. NRX was, for many, many years, the most powerful reactor in the entire world. And all of the plutonium that was produced at that reactor was sold or given to the Americans or to the British for weapons purposes. In fact, the very first sample of plutonium that the British got came from Chalk River just about 7 months before their first atomic bomb was exploded in Australia. And it might very well be that the plutonium from Chalk River was actually in that bomb. They used the experience at Chalk River to plan their own very large reprocessing plant, that is plutonium separation plant, at Windscale in northern England, now called Sellafield. So Chalk River really was born out of the World War II atomic bomb project. And from right up until the year 1985, plutonium was sold to the Americans. Up until 1975, it was sold for weapons purposes. And from 1975 to 1985, it was sold with a proviso that it not be used for weapons purposes. So that's the background. Now, at Chalk River, there was also, because the British were so interested in learning about how to produce plutonium for their weapons program, they actually helped the Canadians to build two, not one, but two reprocessing plants at Chalk River. One was to separate plutonium from irradiated uranium fuel. And there were two reactors at this point. In addition to the small ZEEP reactor, there were two larger reactors, the NRX, as I already mentioned, and the much larger, about 10 times larger, NRU reactor, which is still operating to this day. And again, they took the spent fuel and they ran it through two reprocessing plants. One was to separate plutonium from irradiated uranium. And if your listeners don't realize what's involved here, in order to get the plutonium out of the spent fuel, which is very intensely radioactive, lethally radioactive, they have to dissolve the entire bundle in boiling nitric acid and convert as much as possible into a liquid solution, a very toxic, very radioactive, very heat-generating, and very dangerous, of course. Then they can chemically separate the plutonium from the rest of the garbage, the radioactive garbage that's in there, which consists of hundreds of man-made or human-made radioactive materials that were created during the fissioning of the uranium atoms. So it's very messy, and it leads to large volumes of liquid radioactive waste, similar to those tanks that are at Hanford, Washington. And we have 21 such tanks at Chalk River, which are in the process of being solidified. The contents of those tanks are in the process of being solidified, all but one, which we'll talk about a little later on. And so there was a second reprocessing plant, which was dealing with thorium fuel. The Americans were very interested in possibly developing an alternative route to a new generation of atomic weapons using thorium. Thorium is a naturally occurring radioactive material, about three times as abundant as uranium. It is not a nuclear fuel. It cannot be used to build bombs directly, nor can it be used to fuel a nuclear reactor directly. However, when thorium is put inside a nuclear reactor that is perhaps fueled by uranium, the thorium atoms are transmuted into an artificial isotope of uranium that does not exist in nature called uranium-233. And uranium-233 is an excellent nuclear explosive material. And from a military point of view, the nice thing about uranium-233 is that when it is created, it is 100% enriched. You don't need to enrich it because it's 100% pure uranium-233. As you can well imagine, then, there are all kinds of nasty radioactive waste at Chalk River, and about 50% of those wastes are military waste left over from the not only the World War II atomic bomb project, but the post-war nuclear weapons buildup. Canada sold uranium for the nuclear weapons buildup during the Cold War, which lasted right up until 1965, and they also sold plutonium from Chalk River for the same purpose up till 1975. That's where most of the nastiest waste at Chalk River come from.
What is the nature of that waste, and what has been attempted in the past to deal with it, and how successful has that been?
Well, in the early days of the nuclear program worldwide, these wastes were very badly dealt with. I'll just give you one example. The world's first serious nuclear accident happened at Chalk River in the NRX reactor. The NRX reactor in 1952 underwent a partial meltdown and a series of hydrogen gas explosions that blew the roof off and released radioactive materials into the environment. And there were 1 million liters of contaminated water, very, very highly radioactive contaminated water, the same kind of stuff that's in those tanks at Fukushima right now. You've got about 1,500 tanks of very radioactive material, water. Well, that's the stuff that simply ran through a pipeline and allowed to sink into the soil because they had no emergency equipment on hand to do anything else with it other than to run it into the river. So they sank it into the sandy soil, and of course it does find its way into the river through underground migration. At the same time, they had this devastated nuclear reactor. They managed to prevent a total meltdown, but the core of the reactor was destroyed, and they had to put the core of the reactor, the damaged core, onto a flatbed truck. Actually, it was one of these graders that has a long separation between the cab that pulls the grader and the radioactive hulk of the reactor, which was on the body of the grader. And they had to have a relay team of drivers so that each driver would only drive for a couple of minutes. They'd run to the cab, drive for a couple of minutes, and then run out of the cab, and another driver would run in, and they would drive for another couple of minutes, and then he'd run out. And they just carted this core of the NRX reactor to some place on the Chalk River site and simply buried it there. This will give you some idea of the kind of slapdash methods that were used to kind of deal with radioactive waste at those times. It was just a question of clearing the deck so they could get on with the work. And the work consisted of trying to restore the NRX reactor to operation, which they did. They put in a new core, and they used 600 military men because it was considered a military operation. And many of those military men came from the U.S. Nuclear Navy, under Admiral Hyman Rickover. He said, hey, this is a great opportunity for our boys to learn how to deal with a nuclear accident. So they sent, I think it was about 300 from the Nuclear Navy that came up to Chalk River. And one of those people was Jimmy Carter, who was a nuclear engineer in the Navy at that time. So this is where Carter got his first real-life experience of dealing with a nuclear accident.
And certainly it wasn't his last. I remember the yellow booties at Three Mile Island.
Right. So they did an awful lot of things at Chalk River in the early days. They also vitrified some of the waste. Vitrified, again, for the benefit of people who don't know the word, it means taking the liquid left over from reprocessing, you know, having dissolved this witch's brew of radioactive materials in nitric acid, you can then sort of mix it with other materials and create a kind of a glass block about the size of a 5-pin bowling ball. They made a bunch of these vitrified glass containers and, again, buried them very shallowly in sandy soil in order to keep an eye on them and see how much radioactivity leaked out of them over the years. So this was one of the very first experiments in the world of vitrification of post-reprocessing liquid waste. Now, people have no idea as to how important the Chalk River facility was, not so much to the Americans as to the British, the French, and even indirectly, the Israeli government, because the French, if we go back before Chalk River, just a few years before Chalk River, there was a secret laboratory set up in Montreal in 1942, and this laboratory included some of the top nuclear scientists from Britain and France, as well as Canadians working in a junior capacity, working on the best possible ways of producing plutonium and separating plutonium for military purposes, or for civilian purposes, because they had in mind the idea that plutonium would be also the fuel of the future for nuclear reactors. So they had both a military and a civilian focus at the same time, but the main priority was definitely military at that moment. So when the French went back to France, the Americans would not allow them to, the French, to go to Chalk River because they were considered a strong security risk due to their many European connections and also to some of the communist leanings of some of the people in the French contingent. So they sent them back to France, but those people then knew about the design of the NRX reactor because they had worked with the British on designing that reactor in the first place. So they used that knowledge to help Israel build the Dimona reactor in Israel, which they then subsequently used to produce plutonium for their bombs. Meanwhile, Canada gave a carbon copy of the NRX reactor to India as a gift, and India used that reactor called the Cirrus reactor, C-I-R-U-S. It was a copy of the NRX, They used that to produce plutonium for their first atomic bomb, which they exploded in 1974 in the Rajasthan desert. All of this was going on thanks to Chalk River.
It's amazing because we don't usually hear the background of how deep the roots of Chalk River go and how deadly its influence has been in the world. Now, there's currently debate or discussion or planning taking place in Canada for the Chalk River Near Surface Disposal Facility, otherwise known as the Radioactive Waste Megadump. When was this proposed? What's the thought behind it, and how far has it gotten?
I'm not sure exactly how long ago. I would say about 8 years ago. Due to public prodding, the Canadian government finally woke up and realized that there was a multi-billion dollar radioactive waste legacy at Chalk River and at a few other sites in Canada. There's also a nuclear establishment in Manitoba called the Whiteshell Nuclear Establishment, which is also under the purview of the same organization, Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, that was responsible for Chalk River. Now, when they started taking a measure of the contaminated buildings, the contaminated pits, the contaminated soils, and the liquid waste and the solidification requirements. And, you know, the one thing people should know about radioactive waste is that it's kind of a reverse Midas touch. That Midas, you know, King Midas, according to the legend, everything he touched turned to gold. And so he starved to death because he had nothing he could eat. Can't eat gold. Well, in the nuclear industry, we have the reverse Midas touch, a phrase that was coined by my friend Robert Del Tredici. The reverse Midas touch means everything that you touch turns to radioactive waste. The point is, if you put radioactive waste into a container and then at some future time take it out of the container now is radioactive waste. And if that container is put in another container, then it becomes radioactive waste. And so everything that radioactive waste touches becomes contaminated. And so the volume of radioactive waste just grows and grows. And that's a problem in itself. So when they took stock of all the different sorts of radioactive waste they had, they concluded that it was about a $10 billion problem, a $10 billion nuclear waste legacy, $10 billion of no productive value other than to just protect the environment and protect human health by somehow looking after it very carefully. And, of course, they talk about a cleanup, a $10 billion cleanup, but cleaning up, it gives the wrong impression. When we think about cleaning up, we think, you make it spick and span. No, no. All you do is you move the waste from one place to another place. You can't destroy it. You can't eliminate it because radioactivity is a form of nuclear energy that cannot be shut off. And so all you can do is just move it from one place to another or put it into a different package. And so this $10 billion was really a question of repackaging and repositioning all these radioactive waste. Now, we had a previous prime minister named Stephen Harper, who, although much more low-key and much more clever, in some ways he was similar to Donald Trump in the sense that he didn't believe that we needed all these environmental regulations. And so he fired 2,000 scientists from the environmental agency here in Canada, the federal agency. And he also put the total process of environmental assessment for nuclear facilities entirely into the hands of the nuclear establishment through the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission. So in other words, hands off, everybody. The nuclear people are going to look after their own show. Chalk River was run by what we call in Canada a Crown Corporation. It's a totally government-owned agency called Atomic Energy of Canada Limited. What Harper did was he gutted that agency and put the entire control of the Chalk River facilities as well as the other facilities owned by Atomic Energy of Canada Limited. He put them in the hands of a private profit-making consortium of multinational corporations, one of them Canadian, that's SNC-Lavalin, and two others were American and two others were British. And these guys are operating under a 6-year contract that can be extended to 10 years, and they are responsible now for looking after these wastes and are not answerable to anybody but the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, which we in Canada have found to be largely an enabler of the nuclear industry rather than an effective guard dog, more a lapdog than a guard dog. And the CNSC, for example, in their 17 years of existence, have never refused to grant a permit for any nuclear facility. The commissioners have never refused to grant a permit.
It's the same as the NRC here in the United States, that it is called the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission, as opposed to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Yeah, another way, we like hockey in Canada. Hockey is our favorite sport. And you could say that if you think of the nuclear industry as a hockey team, then CNSC is more the coach of the team rather than a referee. They never send anybody to the penalty box. They never sort of discredit somebody from playing altogether. They simply give them a pep talk. Anyway, this consortium of private companies has now proposed to build a huge mound, 5 stories high, covering an area that would be the equivalent of 70 professional hockey rinks, above ground, less than a mile from the Ottawa River. The Ottawa River is a major river that flows down into the St. Lawrence, and it flows right through the nation's capital, which is Ottawa, downstream from Chalk River. And they propose to put into this dump virtually all of the low, what they call the low and intermediate level waste, not only from Chalk River, but from other facilities, for example, the Manitoba facility I mentioned to you. And that would include a great many post-fission radioactive materials, including a lot of plutonium and a lot of fission products in various forms, in various chemical forms and physical forms that would go into this dump. They say that only about 1% of the dump would be intermediate level waste, but 1% of 1 million cubic meters, that's how much they're talking about, 1 million cubic meters, 1% of that is 10,000 cubic meters. So 10,000 cubic meters of intermediate level waste is a lot of stuff. And the fact that they would put it all into one huge mound, so you might think, well, is this like a staging area? Is this like a temporary thing? No, this is intended to be a permanent facility. And they eventually intend to simply abandon it there. So that's the proposal that we're now facing. And at the moment, there is about 1,000-page environmental impact statement that has been produced, and we have a deadline until August 16th for the public to comment on this, and they hope to get the thing operational by 2020. So that's what we are facing here in Canada, but it's not only Canadians, I think, that should be concerned about this, but everybody around the world, because what we are seeing here is, imagine if Canada goes ahead and does this. What kind of example does that set for the rest of the world? It basically says, don't worry about radioactive waste, even if it's plutonium-bearing waste, even if it's left over from spent fuel dissolved in nitric acid, even if it's the internals of nuclear reactors, all of which will remain dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years, let alone millions of years. But it's okay to just abandon this stuff right beside major water bodies like the Ottawa River, or in another project that you wanted to discuss during this interview, right beside Lake Huron. Those are from commercial nuclear reactors, whereas these wastes that we're talking about at Chalk River are not from commercial nuclear reactors. They're from nuclear research only. But about 50% of that is of the volume would be, in fact, weapons-era nuclear waste. It's basically a weapons dump.
With so much going against this site, I imagine there must be some major opposition that has risen up. What has been the nature of this, and how effective has it been so far?
That's a very good question. And, you know, unfortunately, we have found that the nuclear industry has been pretty good at hoodwinking people, including especially politicians, by convincing them that everything is being looked after very well and that, therefore, you don't have to worry your pretty little head about it. Moreover, they have done a pretty good job of convincing people that this stuff is too difficult for non-scientists to understand, and therefore you couldn't have a reasonable opinion about it anyway, all of which is untrue. The fact of the matter is, this is extremely important material. It's not too difficult for people to understand. It's simply that the industry, including the regulatory body, goes out of its way to cast a veil of mystification over many of these subjects by using excessively technical terms, excessively baffling numerical notations, and making it so that most non-scientists, including politicians, feel that it's a little bit beyond their comprehension, and consequently they better let the experts handle it. Our view, on the other hand, is that we are now, and it's only happening right now in Canada at least, we are now really entering into the age of nuclear waste in a serious way, because never before in Canadian history has anybody proposed to abandon nuclear waste for forever, right by the shores of major river bodies, and without consideration of perpetual ongoing maintenance and monitoring and intervention when necessary in order to prevent any leakage that begins, which is surely going to happen. In fact, even the EIS talks about how much material, including plutonium, will be leaking into the Ottawa River. They don't deny it's going to happen. They simply say it's all very acceptable because it's within what they consider to be acceptable limits. However, these are only mathematical models. They are not reality.
And how strong, how effective has opposition to this radioactive waste mega dump been?
The opposition has been growing, but unfortunately, none of the levers of power are within our grasp. The industry proposes, and CNSC, by law, they are by law the agency that determines yes or no to go ahead with this, and we do not have confidence in the CNSC as a guardian of public safety or environmental protection. In fact, the very fact that the huge mess exists in the first place, the fact that the Chalk River site is such a radioactive horror story, demonstrates that these scientists and engineers in the nuclear establishment have not shown any competence in protecting the environment in the past. Why should we think that suddenly they have become champions of the environment? The difficulty, however, is that this is completely, you can't even go and visit these sites. They are completely off limits to civilians. And because of the fact that Chalk River was deliberately built in a remote area, it's pretty well sort of a local wasteland. The only people living around there are people who work at Chalk River. So the result is that it's hard to get people directly concerned about the project. Now, we have managed to stimulate Quebecers' concerns to a certain degree, but not to an official degree yet. The Quebec government has not yet officially weighed in and declared that they will not tolerate a nuclear waste dump right on their borders, because the Ottawa River is, in fact, the border between Quebec and Ontario. And there are communities living right across the river in Quebec, right across from Chalk River. There are, in fact, public meetings taking place. I'm going to be going to two or three of these in the coming weeks up on the Quebec side. And also, there has been less concern, strangely enough, on the Ontario side, maybe because the Ottawa River flows into the St. Lawrence at Montreal. So it's the Quebecers who are going to be more affected by any runoff from this waste than Ontario people, Ontario residents. So it has been difficult to get an effective mobilization underway. The only thing that I think would possibly work to stop the approvals process of this would be for the Canadian government and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to directly intervene and say, hold on, we do not have at the moment an acceptable environmental assessment process. When Trudeau was running for office, when he was running for prime minister, he actually stated that one of his goals was to restore the integrity of the environmental assessment process, which has not been done. So he has a good rationale for blowing the whistle and says is not adequate, and therefore we have to wait until we have a real consultation process with Canadians and with First Nations to develop an environmental assessment process that can be acceptable, and then object, and some of them are not. That's what we're hoping. Fortunately, we have had an inquiry here in Canada into the environmental assessment.
All